This is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 113 of Speaking of Mysteries for our interview with Julia Dahl, whose Conviction, her third crime fiction novel featuring journalist Rebecca Roberts, was published last week on March 28th. I caught up with Julia 2 days after her pub date to talk about Rebecca, the origins of the storylines of Conviction, and how what has and what hasn't changed about New York City figures into her novels. Here's Julia Dahl. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. We're talking to Julia Dahl, who has just released the third of her Rebecca Roberts novels, Conviction. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. I'm not sure I believe in convergence, but I just interviewed my partner in Speaking of Mysteries, and Laura Caldwell about their Anatomy of Innocence anthology that was just published.
Yeah.
And so many people are aware of it. So maybe there's something in the air that's bringing attention to the wrongly convicted. You know, there was Serial, The Making of a Murderer. Mm-hmm. But I know that you probably started writing this book in 2015. So I was wondering, what brought you to weave the story of a potentially wrongfully convicted man into Conviction?
Well, I started reading about men, specifically from Brooklyn, black men who were being exonerated. And it's in the New York Times. I remember reading an article in the New York Times about a couple men who were exonerated. And I felt like I was reading the same story over and over and over again over a period of months, I think. And one of the stories that really piqued my interest was about a couple of these men, about how several of them had the same detective on their case. And that detective, they said, had coerced confessions and had actually been made up witnesses, had sort of paid a witness to be a witness in multiple different crimes, you know, to say, I saw this person, but in crimes that were in totally different places. And I remember thinking that was just completely insane. And, you know, one of the things that I think of as sort of my mission as an artist, as a writer, is to sort of expose injustice. And it just occurred to me that there's no greater injustice than locking someone away for something they didn't do. And I started to imagine what it would be like to be a teenager, because so many of these guys that I was reading about being exonerated had been convicted when they were teenagers. And then the other thing is that I want to say back in 2013 or so, the book about the Central Park Five came out, and that was a case that I had, you know, heard about, of course, because it was very famous. But Sarah Burns, the daughter of Ken Burns, wrote a book about them, and I went to a couple events and read the book, and I just felt like I was seeing the same details about these convictions over and over again, about kids, you know, teenagers who were frightened, put in interrogation rooms for hours and hours and hours, and finally confessed. And, you know, they didn't have, you know, families with a lot of money for a great defense. And once you make that confession, I mean, it's just almost impossible to walk it back. And then all this research coming out about how kids and people under 21 are much more likely to make a false confession because, they're much more easily influenced and pressured. And all that sort of came together for me. And I thought, I want to write about a teenager who is wrongfully convicted and sort of look at what it would be like to have that experience. And then how that person, you know, 25, 30 years later when they're exonerated, you know, I wanted to look at, you know, how does this not destroy a person entirely? And I was lucky enough to meet with and interview a man who was exonerated just back in, was it 2016? I think maybe it was 2015. And, you know, he hasn't been destroyed by the experience. And I really wanted to sort of tell that story.
And I have to mention that I really liked how you got into the investigation, or how Rebecca got into the investigation of the wrongful conviction part of the story. She visits a character in your book, Amanda Button, to learn about Amanda's homicide blog. And it's a blog that tracks every homicide in New York City. And that brought to mind that some murders get far more attention than others. And that was Amanda's mission, was to acknowledge that people who don't make the headlines, and they, let's face it, they are often people of color and people from the less fashionable neighborhoods who get killed, and they deserve to be recognized, and the crime deserves to have focus put on it. And I thought that was a nice, very, very nice touch. Not heavy-handed, but a nice touch.
Well, thank you. That, you know, that was also really important to me. And you're sort of the first person that's chatted, that's asked me about that. That sort of, I think it's called the Homicide Blog in the book, and it's based on a real blog or website called the Homicide Report that was out of D.C. And then actually the L.A. Times had something similar. I think they called it maybe the Homicide Report. I'm getting it wrong. But for a couple of years, the L.A. Times, the reporter at the L.A. Times, tracked every single homicide in L.A. And it was a difficult job, especially, you know, just one person doing it. But for exactly that reason, that the crimes that get, you know, the murders that get, that make the paper are not every murder makes a paper. And the idea, you know, and I started to think about myself, like, what if someone I knew was murdered? And the idea that their murder, you know, that my whole world is different now and that it doesn't even make the paper, like how disorienting that must be. And I there are people out there doing these sort of accounting for every homicide. And I think it's really, really important work. And I used to have fantasies before I started writing novels about that, you know, creating something like that. And I just didn't have the wherewithal to do it. But there are people who are doing it, and I applaud them. And I hope that, you know, because we do now have, you know, one of the ways that the character in the book is able to report these stories is through social media. You know, you can get, if you know the right sort of hashtags and the right software with Twitter and Facebook, you can figure out, you know, where people are tweeting about, you know, an all right, you know, rest in peace tweet or a, you know, gone but not forgotten tweet, and figure out where these homicides are taking place, and you can start to map them. And then there's all this great information we can find from, you know, mapping those murders and finding out what the trend, you know, what the sort of connections are. Are they gun homicides? Are they domestic violence homicides? Are they gang related? Are they drug related? You know, it's just, it's like this cache of information that we're not really using, and I think that we could be using it better.
And of course, when Rebecca goes to Amanda's house, which is in Ditmas Park, and Amanda does it all from home because she's pregnant with her third child, she's looking through these letters, and she comes upon a name, and in looking at this case, she sees another familiar name, and it's Saul Katz, who has been an important figure in Rebecca's life and actually the conduit for her when we met him in Invisible City, of showing her this, the world of the Hasidic Jews, of which her mother was part of. Was that, it reached out from the past. Was that something that you decided you wanted to do to balance this past and present kind of thing? And I think that must be terribly difficult to do. I know this is a long and convoluted question, but, do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, I'll let you go.
I totally do. And I really wanted to, you know, Invisible City introduces us to Rebecca and to Saul and sort of as the ghost of the book is Rebecca's mother who abandoned her. And the second book, Run You Down, is very much about, I really wanted to explore who was Rebecca's mother and create, you know, sort of give her origin story. And I, for the third book, for Conviction, I very much wanted to explore where Saul came from. And I always had in my head that the third book would focus on Saul in the beginning of his career as an NYPD officer, because we learn through the first two books that Saul, you know, was an officer in the NYPD, that he had left his family and his community in the ultra-Orthodox world, and that there had been some trauma there. And I wanted to dramatize that and for myself and for the readers who, because a lot of people who read the books really like Saul, and I wanted to sort of give them something satisfying to hang on to about his past. You know, when I started to think timing wise about when did Saul start in the NYPD, and it was in that sort of bad old days of the late 80s, early 90s, when, you know, like right now in New York City, we have what, like 350 or so homicides a year. Back then it was like 2,500 homicides, you know, so I mean, it was just an order of magnitude that I think many of us living in New York City now can't quite imagine. And it's not like there were six times that many police officers or prosecutors or judges to sort of keep the system moving. So Saul being a new police officer in that time where police were just getting inundated with, you know, I mean, that, you know, the 2,500 is homicides, but, you know, that doesn't count, you know, arson and rape and assault and theft and all manner of other crime. So it seemed like a great opportunity to sort of tell his story, but to also tell the story of the city that when it was so different from what it is now. You know, now most of us, you know, I'm likely going to have to leave the city because I just can't afford to live here anymore. I was joking with someone who I was a cop, who was a cop back when Saul was. So I was interviewing this man to get a sense of what the place was like back in, you know, 1990-ish. And we were talking about Crown Heights because that's where the book takes place. And I said something like, yeah, we looked at Crown Heights, but, you know, we can't really afford to live there. We can't afford to buy there. And the officer who knows this, you know, laughed. He was like, you know, in 1990, you couldn't give away a house in Crown Heights. And so the dramatic difference between New York City now and then was something I really wanted to explore. And it sort of fit perfectly with exploring Saul's, you know, his kind of origin story, how he became a police officer and how he came to be the kind of police officer he is in the present.
Well, you anticipated the follow-up question, which was how amazing it is, how much New York in general and Brooklyn in particular has changed in the last 20 years. You know, for instance, living voluntarily in Brooklyn and liking it. but I think one of the things, one thing that hasn't changed, though, even as New York has evolved into a safer, saner guardedly, but there's still a basic mistrust between communities. And that's something that Rebecca is exploring both in the case she's looking into in the past with this potentially wrongfully convicted man, and what's still going on. There's still a distrust between communities. The communities may have changed, but the distrust remains.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a theme in a way of all my books, and I think it's, you know, something that's really sort of a problem, you know, in just the larger world, you know, that it's very difficult for people to have empathy for people who are different from them and who live different in a different way. And, you know, if we can't do that, if we can't look at the Hasidim and they can't look at us and find common humanity, if I can't look at, you know, if I'm a Jew looking at a Mormon, or if I'm a Muslim looking at a Christian, or if I'm, you know, Latino looking at a white person, you know, like if we can't find our common humanity, we are just going to, you know, be at war with each other always. And in New York City, that fact is so dramatic because we live, you know, right next to each other. Like I literally live next door to a mosque. And we sometimes think about, and you know, they're good neighbors, and we're good neighbors, and we don't interact much. And because I'm a woman, they don't interact much with me. But even with my husband, they don't interact much. But you know, we're polite to each other. But you know, I think about things like we put a Christmas tree because we're an interfaith family. You know, my mom's Jewish, my dad's Christian, and I'm identified as Jewish. My husband is Catholic, although not practicing. But so we have a Christmas tree in the window at Christmas, but then we are tree topper is a Star of David because, you know, it's just sort of like that's who we are. And I always am a little nervous with the moss next door, like what will they think of us? And, you know, I mean, so I'm always thinking about that. How will people who are different from me react to me? And, you know, am I reacting to people who are different from me in a way that's, you know, with an open heart and an open mind, or am I just like throwing a stereotype? And we all have those sort of built in or at least ingrained in childhood stereotypes. And I'm constantly trying to fight them. And I think maybe just, you know, I feel like the discussion about things like race and gender is more open now. And it's something that we're all talking about. And I think that's a good thing. I think the only way to sort of start to understand each other is to hear each other and really to listen. But like I said, in New York, you know, the fact that we're all just so next to each other makes it so easy to talk about strife between communities because, you know, one community will exist on one street and a totally different one will exist the street next door.
And I should also point out that you're originally from California, which also has a number of different ethnic communities that live side by side, although much more spread out than in New York City. So you're just seeing a distillation of it.
Exactly.
Back to the book, though. One of the things I think your novel demonstrates by who the bad guys are and who the good guys are and how they sometimes change roles is that sociopathy is an equal opportunity condition. Violent people doing bad things are not endemic to one race or religion.
Right. Absolutely. I mean that's, you know, that goes along too with that sort of, you know, understanding that at the bottom level, all human beings are the same. And so we're going to have, say, rates of sociopathy or diabetes or, you know, asthma at, you know, much the same rate, you know, depending on environmental circumstances and stuff. But I do think, you know, it's important that the bad guy, you know, I mean, in this book, good people do bad things. And I think it's important to, you know, remind ourselves that you can be a good person and make a really bad decision. And maybe even make a bad decision for a good reason, but that doesn't mean that the decision isn't going to have really ugly results. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I've tried to, in my book, you know, spread around the bad guy-ness because I think it's important that we recognize that all people can be, you know, all kinds of people can be good, you know, even those communities that you think of as other, but also all kinds of people can be bad, even those communities that you think of as being, you know, sort of very upstanding.
It's not a big part of the story, but I found Rebecca's getting passed over for a full-time job at the Trib, which is her paper, the New York Tribune, by a white male Columbia J-School grad, a very nice touch. any as a former journalist, any particular reason for doing that?
You know, it didn't occur to me actually that he was white, but it did occur to me that the Columbia, you know, the J school thing. Of course, like I mean, I went to J school. I didn't go to Columbia, but I went to J school, and it was actually for me, it made me a much better journalist. So I'm not trying to knock J school, but you know, I mean, I think we're more than the sort of like gender and race element to that was that Rebecca, you know, she basically doesn't get the job because she was sort of striving to do work that she thinks of as more important and better than the work she's doing at the Trib. And she basically got punished for doing that. Whereas the guy who got the job is sort of the, you know, happy to just work a day and do what the editors say and stuff. And for me, it was a little bit of a comment on sort of that you get, you know, you get the job if you sort of go along and if you rock the boat or try to sort of shake things up and maybe do things in a different way. And for Rebecca, it's a way that she feels like is more important and then you're going to get punished, you know.
And my last question Are we going to see Rebecca in another novel?
Yes. I'm writing the fourth novel as we speak, although having a small child has put a major crimp in my writing schedule. But I am definitely writing a fourth novel. It is a Rebecca Roberts novel, and I won't say too much except that it involves a missing NYU student, and it also involves Rebecca. Rebecca has a brother, a half brother, named Deacon, who's several years younger than she is, and grew up with her in Florida. And in the fourth novel, he has come to NYU as a student, and he knows the missing student. So that is all I will say.
Well, it's definitely intriguing. Julia Dahl, congratulations on the publication of your third novel. It's amazing how, as good as Invisible City and Run You Down were, Conviction is even better.
Thank you so much. It means a lot to hear that, and it's totally a thrill to talk about it with you.